Welcome to the Against the Stream Nashville podcast. We're very excited to announce that we are changing our name to Wild Heart Meditation Center. You can stay subscribed to the podcast as you currently are, or if you choose to join us again at a later date in the future, just remember to search wherever you get your podcasts for Wild Heart Meditation Center. We're excited to be introducing new facilitators to our group and expanding our presence in our local community. Enjoy. So like I said, we'll take some time to share first a little bit of a theme on compassion practice I'd like to talk about tonight, and then we'll do some of the practice together. If I was going to title the talk, I think I would call it The Difficult Me, The Difficult You, and The Difficult Us. And how we can practice engaging with difficult people during difficult times, which I think is a relevant topic. I really think it's always kind of a relevant topic, even with maybe more social tensions, whether that's my own perception or whether that's shared in the room or not. I think we're always amidst difficulty in our lives. Whether they're the pressing issues of our more global world, human rights issues, access to health care, environmental crisis, right? Even as I say those words, they can sound a little bit pedestrian and ordinary to roll off the tongue, but these are pretty potent, enormous difficulties in our world. Or whether our difficulties are more personalized, the myriad of financial and romantic troubles that we find ourselves in, or the personal struggles with mental health. I know a lot of folks end up coming here to help cope with anxiety or depression. Or other personal hardships or limitations that we find ourselves in, right? I think that we're always in the middle of what the Buddha calls dukkha, this difficult vulnerability of being human. And so as practitioners of the Buddha's Dharma, we're inviting ourselves into an honest conversation and a personal reflection on the difficulties that we come up against both in our personal day-to-day lives and in our global world. Right? Engaged Buddhism is one of looking at not only our personal psychology, the mind, and our emotional distress, but also the collective suffering that we all experience, right? There's this kind of emphasis, especially in other forms of Buddhism, like Mahayana Buddhism, that emphasizes a sense of oneness or interconnectedness. I think Thich Nhat Hanh calls it interbeing, that my suffering is reflected in you, and your suffering is reflected in me, and my joy, my liberation, my freedom from suffering is reflected in the alleviation of that in both of us. And the Buddha says, in this way, in regard to practicing the four foundations of mindfulness, the meditator will abide in developing mindfulness internally, externally, and both internally and externally. They will abide with mindfulness, contemplating the nature of both what arises and what passes away internally, externally, and both. And so with our attention, the Buddha is really encouraging us to have a deep attention, yonisomanasikara is this word in Pali Sanskrit, a careful attention of what's happening both internally, externally, and between the two. And I like this because anyone that knows me knows that I like to add a lot of information. I'm a very kind of logical-minded person. And so for me, this validates the Buddha's own teachings from 2,600 years ago, right? That he included this not just in a nonchalant way, but in the actual teachings on how one should develop mindfulness or awareness. Internally, externally, and both. So the Buddha was not only interested in personal psychological suffering, but he was also interested in the concrete suffering of our global world. In the Mahaparinirvana Sutta, the Buddha says, as long as a society protects the vulnerable among them, they can be expected to prosper and not decline. Right? And so I don't know who in the room would call themselves a Buddhist, and I personally don't think it matters that much. But I think the important part here is that if we're interested in what the Buddha taught, you know, in these principles of mindfulness or practices, really, of mindfulness and compassion, then I think an important part of the picture is looking at awakening that shares a commitment to ease the suffering of all human beings. I think that a natural expression, as I've practiced the Dharma and I continue this path over the years, a natural inclination of my own practice is to be of service, right? It's something that seems to happen in any path of spiritual practice or personal healing. As we do work, as we start to kind of wake up and to heal ourselves, I feel like we often find ourselves wanting to heal others. So this doesn't mean that all of us should or can respond in the same way, right? The ways that we are of service and help in the world during difficult times will be different. Some of us may engage in direct actions, right? Clinics, community organizing, criminal justice reform, youth empowerment are some examples. Some will work in the next election and politics and really encourage people to engage in those levels of our society. And some will just meditate more and will try to be kinder and more civil in their day-to-day interactions. I think one of the failings of my tribe, and I call it my tribe because we all have our tribes, our political tribes, our social tribes. And as a maybe oppositionally defiant person by nature, I always like to argue with the people that are in my tribe, not the people that are the other tribe. So I always like to argue with my friends, the people that are most like me. And I think one of the things that I argue with the most is that I think people in my tribe, maybe I could call this a more socially liberal type of person, is that we can sometimes call each other out. And we can sometimes, out of our passion for awakening, create judgments and criticisms on each other that prevent us from doing the work. And we fail to see the work that we each other are doing in the world, in small ways, in big ways, in medium ways. And so we're going to be different in the ways that we engage. And we're going to have different views. And this sucks, and I think it's more evident now and probably feels more urgent, and in my opinion is probably more urgent now than ever, that we do have opposing and divisive views, probably for some reasons, but that we're always going to have different views. And so we need to learn how to engage in public spaces with our views and debate and have some dissent and some discomfort. And we're not going to do all of that tonight, but I want to talk about how we do engage with difficult times. And so I think one thing's clear is that Buddhism is an engaged practice, right? What I talked about last week was this principle of karma. And karma is not this deterministic kind of merit bank that sometimes we have this ideology around in our society, that whatever you've done in the past will come back in direct proportion to you in the future. That's not how the Buddha taught karma. But karma just means action. And it means that all actions have results, whether they're actions of omission, like not doing something, or whether they're active actions of doing something. And so engaged Buddhism is using action, right? And inaction. It's withholding from doing things, and it's cultivating certain actions. And so there are kind of four stages. This is just my own framework with how we can engage in compassion during difficult times. And we can apply these to ourselves too, and we're going to talk about the difficult us, and then the difficult me, and then the difficult you. So right now we're talking about how do we all engage with struggles collectively. One is the principle or practice of awareness. Awareness to me just means the activity of looking at what's here. So when you're practicing mindfulness, what you're doing is you're just over and over and over again coming back and looking at what's here. What's here now? And what's it like now? Right? And so on a social level, I think that part of our practice for compassionate action is to look at the issues that are here. Right? And sometimes I know for myself, sometimes because there's so much going on that I have a hard time looking at the issues because I feel flooded by them. Right? And I think with the enhance, of course, of technology and the way that we're getting information, it just seems like if we want to, we can have this hyper awareness of issues. We get bombarded. And I would call this unskillful use of awareness. And I think the Buddha would too. One of the things the Buddha talked about was guarding the mind. And so I think sometimes we need to have some restraint around how much of the issues we consume. And we have to look into a kind of our personal inclination here. We're all kind of wired differently. Some of us are more of the avoidant types. I don't have much awareness. I don't have much interest. Whatever, whatever, whatever. Some of us are hyperactive, right? And we're really engaged and over-consumed or overwhelmed, really, with the awareness of what's going wrong in the world. And so the first step is practicing a wise or a balanced awareness, actively looking at what's here. Are we interested in the issues at hand, right? The Me Too movement, police brutality, withdrawing from the Paris Agreement, environmental global issues, right? There's so much to this thing we call civilization. And whether we want to have that awareness or not, I think it's an essential component of waking up. I think that we have to be intimately aware of how we live as a part of a bigger whole. So that's awareness, and then there's investigation. Investigation is looking into what's happening, like what does it mean or what all is involved? What are the factors of the issues? So in this example, I kind of pointed to global warming is one of the issues amongst many. And then we can kind of zoom in and say, all right, well, what are the factors or what does it involve? Maybe involves some economic things like renewable energy or the industrial boom in China, right? Or capitalism in general, which is a little bit political and economical, right? And then it also includes political factors, like we withdrew from the Paris Agreement, all right? So what does that mean? That's a thing that happened, right? What about our social factors? You know, do we, where do we go to eat? And what do we eat on? And what do we eat with? And what do we spend our money on, right? Those types of things. To just be aware with a non-reactive awareness that these are things to be considered. Let's not even jump into our views or debating it. At this stage, we're just aware, okay, these are things to be considered. We all agree. And then we try to practice this empathy, which just means to feel with. That's what the root word of empathy means. To try to feel with what we're learning through our investigation. So what do we feel about the political factors affecting global warming? Maybe some confusion, like, I don't even know what the hell's happening. I don't know what that stuff means, right? I feel a little bit bewildered or confused. Or maybe I feel some shame around some of my environmental practices, right? Or maybe I feel some hope and some optimism that I can make a change. Maybe I feel some fear. I probably have a lot of feelings as I start to investigate these things. And I think one of the disservices I do to myself is when I'm engaging in these types of conversations and investigation into our collective suffering, I jump so quickly into defense. Because usually I'm feeling all this shit. I'm feeling 80 million kinds of way about 80 million kinds of issues. But if we can practice skillful awareness and narrow it down to a thing, guard the senses, be careful in our investigation, look at the factors, and we can start to understand how we feel about things. And then we can practice compassion. There are two types of words for compassion in Pali Sanskrit. One is karuna, and one is it's a way less emphasized word, but I almost like it a little bit better. It's called anukampa. And anukampa, this definition of compassion, means an active compassion. It, when literally translated, it means crying out at the crying of another. And so this type of compassion is one that when it sees pain, when it feels distress, it wants to help. And so how can we help? That's the step of compassion. Well, what can I do? And what can't I do? We can't do everything that we want to do. So part of compassion is having this wisdom. What can I do about it? I can maybe vote. I can maybe, in this example, ethically consume or recycle. I can engage in dialogue more. I can volunteer, right? I can do a lot of things about a lot of things. And so this is very important. I think that when we start to slow down and look at things more in this kind of like systematic way or more intentional, it doesn't even have to be systematic, but when we start to slow down and really look at these collective areas of suffering, we actually oftentimes find that we feel more optimistic about our ability to affect change instead of feeling overwhelmed. And so some of the things we can talk about later, we're going to talk more about compassion towards ourselves and compassion towards others during difficult times, but maybe some of the things we can discuss are what are some of the ways that we can take action in the greater issues of our collective suffering. Do we practice looking at these issues? Do we practice looking into what's causing them? Do we attempt to feel with or express concern for these causes? And what gets in the way? Like in a humble kind of reflection. For me, feeling overwhelmed by the magnitude of it all. Also, personal exhaustion and burnout. I'm a therapist. I see like 600 people a month. By the time I get done at the end of the day, the last thing I want to fucking do is think about global warming. Let's be real, sometimes, right? So how does my not taking care of my personal exhaustion and burnout on some levels actually cause me to not take care of some other things too? Right? This is seeing karma. This is seeing how actions create results which create other actions which create other results. And then also, which we'll talk about a little bit, is shame and defensiveness can come up when I investigate. You know, if we were to just start talking about race right now, how would that be? If we were to start to talk about gender inequality or even what gender is and how gender differs from sexual orientation, do we believe that? Right? If we were to start talking about and unpacking some of these things, we would be probably would have a little bit easier of a time than some groups, but it would be hard. And because we have, for me, I come up against a new worldview sometimes, and it bumps up against mine. And it takes us sometimes to digest and to integrate. It's like, oh man, I don't know how I feel about that. I was raised thinking there were two genders. There's a man and a woman. That's it. Right? And a few years ago, I learned what gender is and how we kind of socially construct it, how different people have different views. And that was like very hard to put in my worldview. And so for me, defensiveness is another thing that comes up. And so I feel like there could be a lot of conversation with this. I want to almost open it up while we're here, but maybe bookmark any thoughts you have, because I want to also do some of the practices together. So please, as you've been thinking, put a bookmark in. So, why should we be interested in social suffering? The Buddha was a really good salesman, which I love about him. The Buddha was a really good talker. I mean, as much as the Greeks were good talkers and debaters, the Buddha was really a man of his time. He talked about this view, he didn't explicitly call it this, but this view of interconnection, that helping others is actually helping ourselves. And there's one discourse that I really love where he talks about this. He says, by giving others freedom from fear, hostility, and oppression, we ourselves will enjoy freedom from fear, hostility, and oppression. There's something about as we practice service, I feel like I'm living in a more loving world, right? It changes my mental attitude about my worldview, really. When I help someone and I see the fruits of that service, when I like dedicate my time to listen or to help or to engage with something, and I see it affect even just a person, I feel like there's more of that in the world. I remember that part of myself that's capable of that. It's almost like, for me, it's like, oh shit, I forgot that this is what a lot of people do. Because in my mind, I get so critical, and I'm just talking about me, it's my conditioning. I get very nihilistic and cynical and really avoidant and isolative in my mind about the nature of humanity. If you were to ask me on any given day still what I thought about the nature of humans, whether they are good or bad, I would have a hard time with that question. Right? A little bit better than I used to. Because, you know, I sometimes get so involved with myself and my view, and so dragged down by it. But when I practice service and generosity, and when I engage in collective suffering, as the Buddha says here, by giving others freedom from fear, or helping them to feel that there's a less hostile or oppressive world, we ourselves enjoy the freedom from fear, hostility, and oppression. Alleviating another's suffering is in fact alleviating our own. And maybe for the religious Buddhists, we can take this literally. Right? I think it's at least an interesting practice. The Dalai Lama in Tibetan Buddhism, they talk a lot more about rebirth than we do in our lineage. But he says that you should treat each person that you see and meet throughout your day as if they were once your mother in another life. Maybe not your current mother, but a good mother. Or maybe your current mother. But you should treat each being as you come across them throughout your day as if they were a mother in your previous life. And so when we alleviate others' suffering, we in fact are alleviating our own. So we can rewrite this. And this is, and not to get too deep, but for those who are interested, this is part of the non-duality that we come up against in Buddhism sometimes. That means also by giving ourselves freedom from fear, hostility, and oppression, we allow others to enjoy freedom from fear, hostility, and oppression. By giving that to ourselves. It's often in our own suffering and confusion when we don't tend to it that it starts to spill out and create confusion and suffering in the world. And so as we talk about compassionate action in difficult times, we can start to look at how we can practice self-compassion too. And it's really in Theravada Buddhism, in our lineage, it's more of the emphasis. Because the idea here, and we could debate or whatever, but the idea, and it's more of an investigation, is that we have to have some capacity to deal with our own shit to be able to effectively help and engage with other people's shit. So we have to have some, at least, kind of starting point of knowing our own pain and how to work with it to be able to really affect change in the lives of others. Carl Jung says, A man whom is capable of withdrawing all of his projections knows that whatever is wrong in the world is in himself. And if he only learns to deal with his own shadow, he has done something real for the world. He has succeeded in shouldering at least an infinitesimal part of the gigantic, unsolved social problems of our day. That's a powerful message, that somehow if we carry this practice of awareness, investigation, empathy, and compassion into ourselves, we can transform ourselves, and through doing that, we can transform our relationships with others and how we act and react and engage with the world. So where we start in practicing mindfulness is often just trying to get a little bit of some clarity. You know, like sitting down and in the beginning really learning how to ignore the obsessive urgency of the mind, which you'll notice. If you're new to meditation, you'll notice that, yeah, the mind wanders 70-80% of the time, and that's normal. And if you've been practicing for years, you'll notice that the mind still probably wanders 40 or 50% of the time, and that's normal, right? And that's just what the mind does. It has this kind of obsessiveness and this neurotic, storytelling that it gets involved in. And so the first part of just practicing is learning how to create some inner space. I forget who says that, but I like that term. Mindfulness is developing inner space. It's like outer space is our outside world and creating space between ourselves and others. But inner space is creating space between a thought and our reaction to the thought, right? And the thought and how we relate to the thought, or an emotion and our reaction from the emotion, or the emotion and how we nurture the emotion. And so when we develop mindfulness, we develop this kind of equanimity. Equanimity is an ability to step back from identification with our thoughts and this over self-obsession with thoughts and learn how to embody a non-reactive space of observation, of just seeing what's here for what it is. Easier said than done, but the more we sit and the more we practice over time, the less reactive we become. The more still, as Ajahn Chah says, the more still the mind becomes, and all sorts of strange and wonderful things happen in that stillness. And we can observe with more clarity. We build a map. We see where the mind goes. It's kind of like babysitting. You see what trouble it gets into and the stories it tells when it feels lonely or when it's afraid, the reactions it has. We get to see the shortcomings of the mind and not take it so personally. It's just the mind trying to protect. This is equanimity, an ability to be with our present experience without push or pull, just to observe. But then we also develop, we train emotional responsiveness, compassion, kindness, gratitude. These are the heart practices. We can learn how to train our heart to care for what's difficult. You know, we can go out and meet the pain and say, oh, I care about you. I feel you. I know you. I care about you. We can meet the mind in those moments and say, oh, I see you. I feel you. I know you. I forgive you. I forgive you, mind. We can relate to the parts of ourselves. All these thousand parts, like firecrackers that just pop in the mind, right? We can learn how to embody, relax, observe, and care for the parts of ourselves. And so when we practice these heart practices, and we'll do one here in a moment, Bhikkhu Bodhi says, it is suggested to take oneself as the first object for the heart practices. Because true loving kindness for others only becomes possible when one is able to feel genuine loving kindness for oneself. Probably most of the anger and hostility we direct to others springs from negative attitudes we hold towards ourselves. With loving kindness, when we direct it inwards towards oneself, it helps to melt down the hardened crust created by these negative attitudes, permitting a fluid diffusion of kindness and sympathy outward. And so we start by really trying to develop a kind and loving relationship to ourselves. And if we don't have any sense of connecting with those words, or know even what self-love or self-compassion would look like, we just start where we're at. That's what we've got to do. So we start by being interested. What would that even be like to love myself? Forget if I even believe it can happen. I've got to try first, right? Ajahn Sumedho says the path is not to follow the heart, it's to train the heart in Buddhism. So we're not trying to have this sentimental love and what we see in the movies, but we're trying to really actively in the moment say, man, what's here and how can I meet it? Right? Like Rumi says, this being human is a guest house, right? And he says, like, every morning you have a new visitor, a surprise, excitement, an anger, a fear, a hostile, right? Like welling up of emotion. He says, and our job is to invite them in, right? To get to know them, to learn what they need, to take good care of them, to set healthy boundaries with these parts of ourselves, to contain them when we need to. And so we start with ourselves, and I think a big part for our Western world, for me, myself, is like, how do I work with, especially looking at like shame and inner criticism? I think this is a unique kind of phenomenon that we experience here in the West. So much so that when the Dalai Lama was teaching Westerners about the heart practices years ago, and he was talking about practicing love for yourself, one of the people stood up and they said, hey, what do I do about all of this kind of self-loathing that people experience, shame and criticism, that I tried to teach people self-love, loving kindness and compassion, but they come up against this like feeling that they don't deserve it. And the Dalai Lama went back and forth with his translator for like a couple minutes and just couldn't understand what that meant. There was no like Tibetan word for self-hatred, right? And that wasn't a part of that culture. And so I think it's a little bit telling of like how critical and harsh that we can be in this kind of hyper-productivity and achievement in the comparing mind that the Buddha talked a lot about. Brené Brown calls it the inner hustler. And she said, of no fault of our own, the mind often attempts to keep us safe by becoming overly concerned with our status and about what people think, about always being better than and always being right. I think of this part of my mind as my inner hustler. It's always telling me to compare, prove, please, perfect, outperform, and compete. The inner hustler has a shame-based fear of being ordinary. The hustler has very little tolerance for discomfort and self-reflection, a willingness to challenge our self-made stories. Without active awareness, mindfulness, the mind doesn't take responsibility for the stories it tells, nor does it have any interest in writing new endings to them. It denies emotion and hates curiosity. If unattended, the mind will quickly use stories as armor and alibi. Avoiding truth and vulnerability are critical parts of the hustle. And for me, I feel like this is what I'm up against a lot of the time, this kind of inner critical sense of feeling out of place. That's one of the words, the roots for the word dukkha, the sense of difficulty that I talked about. It comes from this etymology that means separate from the other, du-akash, to feel separate from the other. This sense of feeling isolated and alone, or as she says here, this shame-based fear of being ordinary. What if I'm just like everyone else? Right? What if I'm just have the same insecurities and neurotic fears? What if I'm just another human spinning on this globe going, I don't know how many miles an hour, shooting through space, right? My mind has, in NA they call it terminal uniqueness, the sense of like not only being uniquely hip and cool, but uniquely bad, right? I notice this in my mind. It's like relentless in telling me all the ways that I'm not good enough or I'll be happy once I get. And so we have to start with ourselves, I think, in some way, practicing self-compassion. And I want to do some of the practice together. We'll meditate for about 15 minutes,